Today is May 2nd, 2013. This is the second session with George Wyman. We're again at Carolina Meadows in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I'm David Caruso, and here with me also is Jody Roberts conducting the interview. Yesterday, we kind of wrapped up hearing about your time at General Anilin and Film Corporation. You were in Linden, New Jersey, working there for about 4 years. I think that you had started to tell us a little bit about your transition to the National Bureau of Standards, but just for consistency's sake, can you tell us how it came about that you left Anilin and joined the National Bureau?
I didn't like doing applied research with dollar signs in front of it, which is what industry does, and industry has good reason to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I'd like to get back to basic research where the intellectual curiosity is what drives the research. And a friend suggested look into government research possibility. But there are three possibilities, then and still. You work for industry, you get the most money and probably least intellectual challenge. The government, where you have less money, more intellectual challenge. And then the last one is university, like Joe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Joe gets pretty good money, but in general, academic jobs pay the least, but you have complete freedom to do what you want. So I wanted to compromise. I didn't want to step down into academia, which seemed like a 50% salary cut.
Mm-hmm.
But I was willing to take a smaller cut and get more freedom, but not complete freedom, and start to work for the government. And I was lucky because the Bureau of Standards offered me a position which gave me a great deal of freedom in the research, had a lot of fun with it, and a salary cut which was tolerable.
You mentioned yesterday, in some ways, your father was the one that told you, you know, or got you started on the idea of going into chemistry. I asked you about getting your PhD, and you said, well, my father said I should get
go as far as you can
go. Was he still providing advice to you about your career, or was he letting you?
No, he was satisfied with what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. And your sister was, I know she was in the country at this point, was she pursuing a career as well?
Well, yes and no. I mean, women at that time, both in Europe and in the United States, were had a very minor sort of career. She was trained as a cosmetician.
Mm-hmm.
And she worked for a while for Helena Rubinstein, which was a big cosmetic firm. And in New York, they actually had a salon where the richer women would come in, have their hair done and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And she was busy looking for a husband and found one when the war was over and got married, and that was it.
Okay. All right, so how did you actually meet Wallace Brody? And
just, I mentioned that yesterday. I had the intention of looking for a government job when I was in Washington. And the first place to go to, friends suggested, was the Bureau of Standards. I went to the Bureau of Standards, the personnel office. And of course, they didn't really know what kind of chemistry I was doing. They knew they had a bunch of chemists. And they knew they had a division called Organic and Fibrous Materials Division. And the word organic caught them because I told them I had a doctorate in organic chemistry. All right. So they sent me off to talk to the division director of this Organic and Fibrous Division. His name was Mac something, doesn't matter. And he was very helpful. He called some people at NIH, arranged for me to go get into it. Those were days when chemists were there's a shortage of chemists, so a chemist walks in, it's a big thing, he's looking for a job. And he, I suppose, maybe German, anyhow, doesn't matter, he remembered that Wallace Broad had recently come to the bureau, and he was, Broad was this guy's boss.
Mm-hmm.
And Broad intended to start a project, a small research project on dyes. And here I come in from a dye company. So he arranged to have me meet Broad the next day. And that's how I got a job at the bureau. Broad, it turned out, was interested in me because of the dye background, and also because my fluent German, because his student he brought with him, I told you, couldn't pass the German exam. And those days, 1950-49, German was a required language for a doctorate in all universities in the US. About 10 years later, that disappeared. But it was my luck that Wallace Broad was looking for somebody with experience in dyes and in and fluent in German, and I had both of those.
What was the work that they were hoping to do on dyes?
Wallace Broad was interested in correlating the structure of dyes to spectra. Hmm. And doing spectra was a new thing. The instruments were new. Beckman, DU, spectrometer had been on the market for maybe 4 or 5 years, but there was a point-by-point measurement, and Carey, Howard Carey, brought out his company was known as Applied Physics Corporation. He started making a recording spectrometer. The same, get the same, there's really no difference in what one would do versus the other, the Carey and the Beckman, except Carey you get a spectrum, a line, and Beckman you get point by point. You have wavelength 340, you get a point, 350, the next point, you have to do it just like this. And it was very, very time consuming. Mm-hmm. So the Bureau was very proud that it got the number 30 Carey recording spectrometer, the 30th that Howard Carey had put on the market. And we got, and John Gould, fellow worker with me, and I, we had the Carey all to ourselves. Hmm. So Broad was very interested in getting the spectra of these dyes, any dyes.
Hmm.
And of course, what he wanted, because he was a physical organic chemist, was a correlation. The correlate the structure of the dye with what the spectra will show. But instead of that, we found that the dyes that I had changed because there's a chance for cis trans isomerization, and this was red hot. Nobody had ever seen cis, never heard of cis thioindigo. We published 2 or 3 papers in a hurry, and this was something new. And then we pursued that. We looked for cis indigo, and if I'm right, nobody still found cis indigo because of the hydrogen bonding. Then we got half and half thio and indigo, and then you don't find cis half half indigo either. And then we went to the azo compounds. We cleaned up some things in the literature that were sort of ambiguous. We got my friend John, my colleague. He devised the gadget for the instrument. So if there was something in there that was unstable, that was maybe stable only for maybe 50 microseconds, you could still find evidence for it. It was something called a shutter illumination device. We published a paper with that. John Gould and Wallace Broad and I. We had... I'm sorry, I don't have reprints anymore. I threw them away.
Oh, well, that's fine. We can always get the...
You can find them. This is the... well, just search by my name and you're going to find about 20 reprints from the periodicals of the Bureau of Standards. I mean, 20 articles. And John Booth has his name on some of them. And we had a great deal of fun finding out a lot of new things about some of these dyes, the Thai indigo dyes, indigo, half indigo dyes, azole dyes. I don't know what else. A few other things.
Well, you mentioned this just briefly yesterday about the role of the new instruments that were coming out after the war. So was this new opportunity at the Bureau of Standards really about applying some of this new equipment and this new instrumentation to an area? And
well, they were applying it for this particular project. That mm-hmm. instrument was used just for this project as a spectra of dyes, Wallace Broad's project.
What kind of experience had you had with any of this equipment before you got to the
Zero.
Bureau of Standards? So what was that
but
transition
so
like?
So did everybody else, you see.
Right.
There was no recording spectrometer. The John Gould, my friend, and he's dead now, he, and a former student of Wallace Broad's from Ohio State, he was one of these chemists who had a very good instinct for instrumentation. He could modify instruments, he knew how to fix them when something was wrong. He was very, very good at that. I was always a complete dud with it. So John and I complemented each other. I knew more about the chemistry and he knew more about the instruments. Mm. And as a result, we had some, got some very good results. The funny thing about the Carey spectrometer, what was it? Model, I can't remember the model number, but it was the workhorse everywhere after Carey brought it out. And it was Carey's company was known Applied Physics Corporation. And at UNC, when I became an adjunct professor, I got involved in some of the photochemistry at UNC. This was now in the 70s. My friend David Whitten, who was a faculty member then, discovered a Carey sitting in a shed somewhere. Nobody was using it. By then, the Carey had been superseded by more sensitive instruments. But this Carey that he found in the shed gave him a lot of good results. And I mean, good meaning reliable results. Was some of the things that David was interested in, which was energy transfer and sensitized isomerization, things like that. David is now in New Mexico, having left here to go to Rochester. I don't think Rochester is the shortest way to New Mexico.
No. Probably not.
Anyhow, he was a terrific guy, and it was a big loss to the department when David Whitten left.
When we were speaking yesterday, and this was during the time that you were at Cornell, you brought up that in some ways there was this old guard of chemistry.
Inorganic chemistry.
That, you know, they were very stuck to the way things had been done for so long. There were some new professors coming in to push things in a new direction, right? And it sounded like those groups, I don't want to necessarily frame it as they didn't get along, but they had different perspectives.
Let me tell you what happened. It's interesting. These two guys came in, I told you, Rubin and Talbot.
Mm-hmm.
And after 5 years or 6 years, whatever it is, question came up, should the two guys get tenure? And the old guys had to be making the decision about the tenure for the new guys. And Henry Talbot, who got a Nobel Prize 20 years later, almost didn't get tenure.
Hmm.
He did get tenure and Rubin did not.
Hmm.
And which they both were very bright. Rubin was kind of ruffled the feathers of the old guard more than Taube. Taube was more diplomatic about knowing it all and knowing all the new stuff. Mm-hmm. Rubin was much less diplomatic about it. So this was a personality case, and Rubin then got a professorship though at Ohio State. I visited him last time I saw him. He was at Ohio State. This was 1955, maybe. And Taube stayed at Cornell. And in 1960 or so, he moved to Chicago, stayed there maybe 8 or 10 years, and then he went to Stanford. And at Stanford, he got the Nobel Prize. Mm. And Henry Taube is dead now, but he was, and he, most of the reason he got the Nobel Prize is because he applied that new inorganic chemistry to a lot of systems that had been treated with the old system, with the old approach, and the new approach gave much more interesting results, much more good stuff. I was a great admirer of Henry as soon as he got to Cornell because he applied kinetics to inorganic chemistry. Mm. The old guard was not interested in kinetics. Mm.
The reason I raised that was I'm curious to know, with new instrumentation making its way into labs, I'm assuming you were going to conferences, I mean, clearly you were publishing papers, was there any sort of division in the chemistry community more broadly over the use of these instruments? Were there people who said, you know, we don't need these things, and others embracing them? Or was it just, you know, this is a new toy to play with?
You see, I can't really tell, because by then I was not at the university. Mm-hmm. At the Bureau of Standards, where I was at the time, let me think. Well, again, there were old timers and there were and you guys, and Bureau of Standards was quite an old line agency. I mean, there was I gave my first paper at an ACS meeting while I was at the Bureau. And I liked it, so I decided I'd try to get the paper ready for every ACS meeting. Well, that didn't go so big with the old-timers. One of the division directors had a wife. I guess they all had wives. And this wife was the division secretary. And I came in, I said, I got a paper for the Chicago ACS meeting. And but you presented the paper at the last meeting. You can't go again. You can go, but we're not going to pay you. And I said, well, it's in the paper. No, it's not. So I hitchhiked or whatever. And then the next meeting, I had 3 papers. That wasn't enough either. So I got a carpool of other people who didn't get the money. That was a Chicago meeting again, and we... It was 3 people, they all had papers on the program, and none of them got money from the Bureau to go. So the old tradition was that going to a meeting was sort of a privilege, and if you go this year, you sure as hell don't go next year, probably the following year either, and so forth. And never mind if you in between got a Nobel Prize, I mean, that's irrelevant.
So it does sound like, though, that, I mean, since your papers were getting accepted at the Society's meetings, the Society was interested in what you were doing. So it sounds like, at least in terms of the interest in that form of science, there was interest in the community.
There was, yes.
Okay.
And I think more and more, perhaps, in addition to the use of the instruments, if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what you were seeing because of the instruments and what that was doing to the larger community. So you've obviously spoken a lot about suddenly seeing a summarization where that wasn't something that people were really thinking about with natural dyes and synthetic dyes, that this equipment was providing a new perspective. And I think this is where you end up spending a lot more of your time going forward. But how much of that you were allowed to participate in or that you were able to see from the Bureau?
I finally worked out a system as follows. You guys are too young, but for a period in the 1950s, the ACS only had national meetings in three locations: New York, Atlantic City, and Chicago. No, none of this Philadelphia, Philadelphia is a hick town, you know, all these others. So, Bureau, I was working in Washington. So I could easily afford to get a cheap hotel room in Atlantic City. I sure as hell couldn't afford travel costs to Chicago and a hotel room. So I paid my own way to the Atlantic City meetings and tried to get the Bureau to pay my way to Chicago. New York was a toss-up. But I think I had a paper every year. I mean, not every year, but every ACS meeting. But this is one reason I left the Bureau, because that was pretty niggardly, I thought. And here there are people who never had a paper, and yet they are sending them at the Bureau cost to Chicago. Because it was their turn. They hadn't been in 18 years, so it was time for them to go. I mean, see Chicago. All right, now that's a sideline. So at Natick, it was easier. I mean, there you, if you had a paper, they'd send you. It was a new organization. We were trying to make a splash on the horizon, and we did by having papers at the meetings and not just having attendance. Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I do want to ask about, and you haven't mentioned this, so I don't know when this started to happen, but you did get married in 1951.
Happens to the best of us.
Mary Truitt.
Yeah.
Was she someone you had met when you were down at the Bureau of Standards? Okay. Was she working there, or is she?
No, she worked somewhere else. So she worked for the government. She worked for the Army, actually. Mm-hmm. And she died 5 years ago, something like this. And we have one child, and the child is in Raleigh, just around the corner, you know. Mm-hmm. But the child has my grandson. And my daughter raised him alone because her husband, the boy's father, died very young. Mm-hmm. And the boy went to Duke, and Duke paid most of the expenses because she didn't have much income. Mm-hmm. And the kids got a job with Microsoft in Seattle. And he just graduated from Duke last year. You know what they're paying him?
A lot.
More than we're making.
$95,000.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Your daughter must be very excited. Very proud of him.
My daughter works for the school system, and they don't pay much. Mm-hmm. And I was worried, I can leave some for my daughter, but the grandson will have to make his own way. Make his own way, hell. He flies right and left all the time. I mean, he's getting to be a world traveler. He loves Microsoft.
What does he do for them?
I can't tell. He's not a computer guy. Mm-hmm. He's more, he's not a salesman. He's just sort of put on a good face and
public relations?
That sort of thing, but individual, I don't know. I mean, he majored in business and psychology. And this is sort of the psychology of business. Mm-hmm. And now it may be that he's lucky that he went to Duke. Bill Gates' wife went to Duke. Mm-hmm. And in fact, she gave him the whole science complex.
Wow.
And she's on the board of trustees, she's everything. And whether there's some kind of a special connection between Microsoft and Duke, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if there is a little something there.
Sure.
But certainly as far as my family is concerned, well, when I'm gone, he can look after his mother.
Did getting married, when was your daughter born?
57.
Okay, so that's after you were...
She was born in Frankfurt.
In the army. So did getting married change your work schedule at all? Or did it stay relatively standard when you were at the Bureau?
Well, wait a minute. I'd left the Bureau. But no, I was still at the Bureau when we got married, yes. But shortly after that, I left the Bureau and went to work for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and the answer is no, the getting married didn't affect my work in any way.
You mentioned that one of the reasons you left the Bureau was their reluctance to support you going out into the community to give papers. Were there any other reasons why you didn't want to stay at the Bureau?
Pay.
Okay.
I mean, a friend came up to me and he said, I'm now working for the Army, the Quartermaster Corps. And the Quartermaster Corps is paying me real good money. They're building a brand new research facility in the Boston area. And they'd like you to come. They told me that to staff that facility, and I would like you to come and head a research laboratory, a small one. Doing much the same what I was doing at the Bureau, but giving me a 20% pay raise. I mean, wouldn't you go?
Yes, probably.
But it had to be.
Furthermore, I was a skier, and the Boston area is a great place for skiers to live.
And it seems like it was an exciting time. You started your work at the Bureau. You said no experience with some of this new equipment, and now you're headed to this new office up in Natick, and your
new facility,
and you're running the whole operation of that division.
They had fantastic instrumentation.
Right.
We had a funny thing there. I mentioned to you the Carey spectrometer. Okay. Well, this was a new facility. When the government builds a new facility, there's a lot of money around usually,
mm-hmm.
and they don't really know what the money is going to be used for, but they want to use it. So if it's a research laboratory, they go out and see what's on the market, and they buy the most expensive instrumentation, and they don't know what they intend to do with it. So I arrive on the scene there, and there is the latest model Carey spectrometer. Well, I knew the next latest model from the Bureau was not much different. Okay, well, we know what to do with the Carey spectrometer. But because of the extra money, the Army spent thousands for a fluorescence attachment for this. And I said, what am I supposed to do with that? And they said, we don't know, but we just had the money. So well, I hated to see the thing sitting in a cabinet. So I started reading about fluorescence, and I published a couple of papers after a while, and a fluorescence spectroscopy is a very fascinating part of physical chemistry. And the grandfather of fluorescence spectroscopy became a very good friend of mine, a German professor who's dead now. And what happened is, here I'm in Natick, and here's the fluorescence instrument, and we had access to the MIT library, and of course the MIT library had everything. So I said, well, go to the MIT library and read about fluorescence. I mean, I knew nothing.
Mm.
And I get this one book, which was in German, by Theodor Förster. I said, I got to read it. And it's, the title was Fluorescence of Organic Compounds. And there was nothing like it in English. I said, I got to read this. That's what I'm dealing with. Is if I'm going to use this, I'm going to use the organic compound. That's what the book is about. And the book told me all about fluorescence. I learned about fluorescence. And then when I got to Europe a year or two later, I got to be real friends with Theodor Förster. And he should have had a Nobel Prize. Anyhow, so I published one or two papers with fluorescence, and I learned something where you could use that as a special, an additional tool to the spectroscopy that you normally be doing. But the only reason I got into it, because the army had the money, they bought the instrument, nobody knew what to do with it. All right.
One thing that I find, or I'm interested to know more about with regard to your career, is that you're in the army. You're working as a civilian, but you're in the army, or the armed services.
I work for the army.
You work for the army.
The army.
Right. You work for the armed services. And during the time where, I mean, the Cold War is framing much of what's going on in American science. And I was wondering, as we discuss your career, and I think you finished in 85, if you could let us know if there are times where you see the science changing in response to the Cold War going on, or things along those lines. And we don't have to cover it now, but just something to keep at the back of your mind as we discuss.
One instance that comes to mind immediately was, this was much later when I was an administrator for the Army. And every now and then you got these leads from headquarters. And wait a minute, this was not the Cold War, this was Vietnam, this was worse. Somebody in Washington, we were worried about the good Vietnamese and the bad Vietnamese. And somebody in Washington had the bright idea that we should be able to tell them spectroscopically by chemistry because they eat different things. And the good Vietnamese going to, I don't know, they eat steak dinners or something, and the vapors that they exude, we could pick up on a sensitive instrument, and that you could tell that the guy behind the bush is a good Vietnamese, but behind that bush is the bad Vietnamese, because he doesn't eat steaks, he eats, I don't know, little pigs or something. And they wanted us to try to work out a system by which we could actually detect this. Well, this was ridiculous. But you get things like this from the uninitiated, from the uneducated. I don't know who had the bright idea. So no, this was not the Russian, this was the Vietnamese, the good Vietnamese and the bad Vietnamese. And so that would have been, 1975 is when the Vietnam War was over. So this probably came pretty late, 1971, 1970. And we had this thing. Oh, we had all kinds of crazy things from headquarters. Flame retardants. There's quite a bit of research going on. It was mainly halogen, I can't remember exactly. It was halogens in the gasoline. It wasn't really chlorine or bromine or anything, but bromides, mm-hmm. something like this. Put that in gasoline, and then it'll be a fire retardant, and mm-hmm. your gasoline will last longer, your engine will last longer. Actually, later on, after a year or so of experimenting with this thing, they discovered that it all worked out fine. You get less flammability. There was less flammability for the gasoline, but the engine was eaten up. And the engine was gone, the gasoline was fine. That was not exactly what they were looking for. So
where was that research happening? While you were up at Natick?
No, I can't remember. It was, I think it was mainly at Edgewood.
Mm-hmm.
Edgewood was the chemical core.
In Maryland.
Maryland, yeah, right. Edgewood, Maryland. So every now and then you had these bright ideas that fizzled. Then sometimes there were some bright ideas that worked well, and you had to try them all. The reason I remember the flame retardant thing is because I remember I was director of chemistry division then at the Army Research Office. And some big wheel was coming down from Washington. We had to give them a briefing about all these programs that we were instituting to make a difference in the war effort. I think this was, this may still be in Vietnam probably. And my boss asked me, did I have anything going in this thing about keeping the engine from reducing the flammability of the fuels, things like that. And I said, no, I said, I don't. I said, well, why don't you have one? I said, because he didn't give me any money. Well, I said, maybe we'll give you some money. But then about 6 months later, the word came out that yes, the flammability was reduced, but the engine was going to hell. So that was the end of that project.
Was that research that was happening internal to the U.S. Army, or were these
yes.
kind of corporate partnerships, just all internal?
Both. There was some. The corporate research was done mainly from the outside. The university research was done here. I mean, was administered from Durham. The Army Research Office, which handled all research support in universities, was here in Durham, at first on a new campus, and later on out in the Research Triangle, and I think it still is out there. The U.S. Army Research Office, it's very near the airport. And that's where I came back from Frankfurt, because they offered me the job of being director of their chemistry program.
So I want to make sure we cover what you were working on while you were up in Natick for those years.
Natick is a suburb of
Boston.
Boston, 20 miles.
So should we just say Boston?
20 miles west.
So what were you doing? What were the main projects that you were working on while you were in Boston?
The main project was pretty much what I did in the Bureau of Standards, was these dyes, the photochemical cis-trans isomerization of dyes. And then I incorporated, once I educated myself, dyed the fluorescence. Now, interestingly enough, my cis and trans thioindigos, the trans fluoresce, the cis do not fluoresce. And that could be predicted based, if you read my friend Furster's book carefully, that that's to be expected. And what else did we do?
So why was the quartermaster interested in...
Well, the quartermaster, among other things, provides all the textiles for the...
Well, sure.
For the military.
But why, as an internal matter to the Army, are they worried about dyeing clothes? I mean, is this in terms of thinking about, you know, is this technology that has potential for thinking about camouflage? Is this...
Yes. There's some basic research that they're interested in on dyes, and then there's some applied research, and they have a pretty strong applied research program at Natick, where it comes down to the dye and the cloth together. I mean, it's again, it's no good to have a dye which is perfect if you cannot put it on a cloth, or vice versa. And the applied people, we had some interaction, not as much as there should have been. Actually, I didn't stay at Natick very long.
Right.
And that was kind of a fluke that I left.
How did that happen?
Well, in every major installation, perhaps even at your place, you get a weekly bulletin of some sort of activities, visitors, that sort of thing. And management can put any kind of an ad in there, if you want to call it an ad. And one day I pick up one of these weekly bulletins and it says, the Army is looking for a senior physical scientist who's knowledgeable in the major European languages for the European, new European office. And the war had been over 5 years, 6 years, no, more than 10 years now. And I was interested in Europe. I hadn't been back, and it seemed like a tempting point. And the grade level was top. The salary top. And so I strolled with my wife, who was pregnant. She was not at all happy the idea of traveling while I'm pregnant. And decided I'll apply for this. I didn't know, I wasn't a senior scientist as they constitute this. I was grade level civil services steps. I was a 13 then, and this was a 15. It was a big jump. 15 was the very top of the civil service. But I was tempted. And I didn't know if they'd consider my language as adequate. Hey, Hungarian is not a major language. German, yes. English, everybody speaks English. My French and Italian were very sketchy. All right, but I told them. And then I wasn't a senior scientist. I was 13 out of 50. They knew that. And the recruiting was done directly from the Pentagon. And I made about 3 trips down to the Pentagon. And most of my interviews were concerned with my wife's pregnancy. Because the Army has a strict rule, no pregnant women are transported overseas after the first, in the 6th month of pregnancy. Then you have to wait until the child is 6 months old and then you can go again. But there's a period where they will not transport. Well, so the question is when are the 6 months up and all this? Nobody tested me for French or Italian or anything. And finally I had the offer, but they couldn't have me at a 15 because there was a rule that you can only go up one step at a time. But they promised me a 15 after 1 year. Well, that was still very attractive. And I took the job, and I was the only civilian on board. They had a bunch of lieutenant colonels and one colonel with some technical background. And they didn't know where to go. They didn't know what to do, really. Because what they wanted is to establish a interaction with the European scientific, science meaning all sciences. And for that they wanted one guy who would cover all sciences. Well, we may have a few of those in the country, but I don't know if there are many. And I took it, and it was great fun. And then I don't know if they thought I did a very good job, and that's why they decided to hire another civilian, or if they thought that I did a bad job, and that's why they felt that they had to hire a second civilian. But they did. They got a fellow who was a computer sort of a guy. This was 1950s, so I mean, not many computer guys in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And he stayed a couple of years, went somewhere else. And the following year they hired two more civilians. So by the time I left, there were four civilians. Mm-hmm. And I'm in different fields. I was the chemist, this guy was the math. There was a fellow who was biology, and then a fellow from ONR, not ONR, NRL, was a physicist. So there was one for four different sciences, mm-hmm. which makes sense. I mean, mm-hmm. the physicists followed leads in physics, I followed leads in chemistry, all that. Mm-hmm. And when they hired me, they really got a bargain. Because my former boss at the Bureau of Standards, Wallace Broad, he knew everybody who was anybody in science in the world. I mean, starting with Nobel laureates, I mean, everybody. He was a former president of the Optical Society of the ACS, a lot of other things. And he gave me a long list of people where I could look him up and say, Wallace Broad suggested I look you up. Mm. And I give you a very good example here of how that really paid off. I arrived, I'm the only civilian scientist. The war ended 6 years ago, 8 years ago, whatever. And my military colleagues are wondering what could we do to have interaction between the U.S. Army and some of the formerly neutral countries. I mean, you could easily have interaction with the Germans because we liberated Germany and whatnot and some of the other countries. But Sweden and Switzerland and those countries, they didn't want any part of us during the war, and they didn't feel much any closer than that 10 years later. But Wallace Broad's list had a long string of important people from Switzerland, Germany, Switzerland, Sweden. And so when this problem came up in one of the staff meetings, I said, well, let me try. I had a name of a recent Nobel laureate in Sweden on Wallace Broad's list. I said, I go up. Set up an appointment to see that guy. And if he sends us a proposal, we had a little money for research proposals. If he sends us a proposal, then we tell him in the States when they evaluate it, that never mind what he sends in, approve it, because there would be nothing better than to be able to say that, what was his name? He was a biochemist. Anyhow, he had a Nobel Prize 2 years earlier, so everybody knew of him. And that we could then say, U.S., that this guy, whom everybody knows, is getting U.S. Army support. Why wouldn't you? I mean, all the other Swedes think that this guy, their top scientist at the time. So, sure enough, I write him. Very nice guy, come visit me, this is the university, he takes me home for lunch, tells me about his grandchildren, whatnot, and then he talks to me about some of his research interests, and then he looks to me, he was very modest sort of fellow, I mean, never mind Nobel Prize. And he turns to me and he says, do you really think the U.S. Army would be interested in supporting this? And I said to myself, hell, if this guy would give me 2 pages from the Uppsala telephone book, we'll support that, because it will open up the whole country. Yes, I said, sure. I mean, I didn't know much about what the research was talking about. Sure. So then we got a proposal from him. We sent it with red flags back to the States for evaluation. You can either evaluate this to support it or else to support it. I mean, there's no ifs and buts about it. And sure enough, it came back, approved, and he got his money, and the army got its money's worth. But from there on, Sweden was open. And again, I can take no credit for it. Wallace Broad gave me his name. I could write to him and say, Wallace Broad suggested I look you up. And the same happened in Switzerland, except there it was a geographer. Well, I didn't know anything. I mean, I like geography, but I have no claim to fame in geography. And again, he opened up Switzerland for us, because he also sent in a proposal. And we became friends for quite a while. So I had this very special baggage with me that I can take no credit for, because Wallace Broad is the one who, he was 30 years older than I was. I mean, he'd been around, and he, as I say, he knew everybody who was in there.
One thing that I'm not entirely clear on is what the Army thought it would be getting out of these relationships. Was it looking to use these scientists to conduct more research for the Army? Was it just looking for potential future collaboration? I don't fully understand what they're...
All right. It varies, and it still varies. These offices still exist in Europe, and in fact, the Army, Navy, Air Force also has a presence in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where else. The money available for research support in Europe, in the first place, ONR never got interested in research support in Europe. ONR in London is a place for American university scientists to take a sabbatical, go to ONR in London, and then develop contacts with Rome, Paris, whatever, and whatnot, and then go home after 1 year. And they don't really do anything for the Navy. They establish some contacts between American science and the guy doing blah blah in Rome and somebody else in Paris and anywhere else, and they exchange reports and frequently get the professor in Rome may have a senior graduate student whom he would like to send to the States. They establish this contact so the senior graduate student can go to the States a year later, that sort of thing. I had a very good friend. Spent a year with ONR London, and he was from Wayne State, and he had, for a couple of years, he had all kinds of students, graduate students, postdocs, whatnot, coming from Italy, from Germany, from wherever. He made the contacts in his year in London, and the contacts paid off by getting these students to work for him in Detroit a year, 2 years, 3 years later. So this is good. Now that's what the Navy does. It's completely different from what the Air Force does. And the Navy does not have any of its own staff. They're all these transients, these professors, a professor from UNC may be working for ONR London next year, you and I don't know. We could find out, but it's no great secret. But you establish these contacts, and they're good. The Air Force, which also means that ONR London, I think, had one or two scientific personnel of their own. I'm not counting the guy who cuts the payroll and that sort. All right. Now the Air Force does just the opposite. The Air Force is in Brussels. I'm sorry, they are all in London now, but at the beginning they were in Brussels. And the Air Force had no civilians. They had only Air Force officers. Now, Air Force had a fair number of Air Force officers with PhDs in this or that or what in sciences. And the Air Force does a little of both. They have some money to support Joe Doakes in Sicily to, if they have something of great interest to the Air Force, they can give him $25,000 or something and have him work on that project and get the reports to the appropriate Air Force lab in the US that has an interest in whatever this guy is doing. And the Air Force staff is all military, but they all technical military. They are scientists, although they're wearing uniforms. Now the Army, the other thing is, the Navy started in 1948. The Air Force got into Brussels in 52 or 53. And the Army, when I got in, was in 56. They established the office in 55. And the Army probably established the office because the Navy was already there, the Air Force was already there. They didn't know what that was, but they didn't want to be left out. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now the Army, on the other hand, in 56, decided they'd have a little bit of money. And a little bit of dollars went a long ways in 56 to support a German scientist in Germany, an Italian scientist in Italy and whatnot. If the subject was of interest to the Army, the reports would go to the Army. And every now and then, and there'd be one laboratory in the US that has primary interest in the work in Frankfurt. I shouldn't say Frankfurt, because that's where the office was, coincident, say Munich. And say at the end of the research, or maybe even during the research, they'd encourage the two investigators, the one in the US whose primary interest in the project, mm-hmm. and the one in Munich, to get together somewhere, probably usually in the US, in wherever the US scientist is located, get better acquainted and maybe shape up the research even more so the Army interest. Now later on the Army research money dwindled, and when I was there the second time, I served two tours there. I was there in when my daughter was born, which was 50s.
Right, 50s, 56 to 60, and then 77 to 83. 77.
But by 77, there was very, very little money. Mm-hmm. And what we did have is travel money. And we'd roam around Europe, go to meetings and things, and then we'd find there's a professor in Stuttgart who's doing the sort of thing that is of great interest, say the Army's Edgewood Laboratory. Well, then we get acquainted with the guy in Stuttgart and say, well, we know that there's some people in Edgewood with a real interest in stuff you're doing. How would you like to spend, we'd pay you away, you spend a few days in Edgewood the next time you want to visit your daughter-in-law in California or something, or mm-hmm. whatever reasoning they want. And then we'd pay his way, pay his expenses while he's at Edgewood, and get these two together. And then later on, if there's real compatibility, I mean real, they love each other, Edgewood may find, the guy Edgewood may find money in his own budget, in Edgewood, to support the guy in Germany.
Okay.
But the office in London doesn't really have money to support these guys. It has $2,000 to send him to Edgewood for 3 days, and that's it. If any research support comes out of it, it'll have to come out from a stateside budget.
So your job primarily was identifying and helping to set up these relationships.
What?
So your primary role was to help identify and then establish these relationships.
That's it.
So
and
were
we,
there...
And we did. We had some people who, some European scientists who'd come regularly, say twice a year, to a particular location, a particular army laboratory, and they were received with open arms and whatnot, and it really helped the army lab, who are otherwise somewhat, scientists in army labs and probably in Air Force labs also are somewhat isolated from the scientific community. They don't do much that's in the public eye. Hmm. So this really helped the American side quite a bit.
So were there places or people you could not approach?
What do you mean?
So
given that it was, again, the Cold War, there were probably certain scientists in countries that
well,
you could not approach.
Only Western Europe. When there was a Cold War, it was only Western Europe.
So when you were established in Frankfurt, you couldn't cross Western Europe? In terms of establishing,
I could go to a meeting in Eastern Europe. I went to, some of these meetings are kind of funny. There was a meeting in a spectroscopy meeting in what was then still the Soviet Union, in Tallinn, which was Estonia originally, and the meeting was full of Hungarians, for example. And what do you think the Hungarians were doing in Estonia at the meeting? What were we meeting? Where would you think you'd find them most of the time? At the beaches. And no beaches in Hungary. No ocean. This is the ocean, this is the Baltic. But they just love the beaches.
Yeah.
So I discovered the Hungarians were not at the meeting, they were at the beaches. I was interested in talking to some of the Hungarians. And of course I had a special, to talk to them in Hungarian is different than if you have questions or something in English. And that was in Tallinn. Where else did I go? I actually became quite friendly with an East German scientist who's also working on indigos. And he was from the university in Jena. And he invited me to give a seminar at the university in Jena, which was East Germany. And I gave a seminar in German about indigo dyes. This was, 1977. Later on, I helped him go to a meeting in England. I mean, these were sort of side things. And then much later, I heard he committed suicide, but it was mainly because I think his wife left him. Mm. And, But having, for you as Army scientists, to give a seminar in East Germany is not very often.
One thing that you had mentioned about your time once you went abroad was the fact that that was pretty much the end of your research.
What?
That was pretty much the end of your research career. You did little bits occasionally thereafter, but you were pretty much now in this administrative role, and I was wondering how you felt about that.
All right. I did research at Natick. I did no research when I went to Frankfurt for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 3 years gap is permissible. I mean, you can still come back to research. But I did some soul searching, and I said to myself, I said, well, I'm a pretty good research scientist. I'm not likely to win a Nobel Prize, but I'm a very good administrator. And I had some other pluses in terms of foreign languages and things like that. As an administrator, I was thoroughly acquainted with the Army R&D system. So it seemed to me that I could do better as an administrator. But then the offer of the job in Durham came up, and that had a lot of appeal because at that time we were encouraged, the senior staff at the Army Research Office was encouraged to do research on a part-time basis at the neighboring universities and neighboring knee-deep universities, as you know. We got UNC here, we got Duke, I was living in Durham, we got NC State, a stone's throw away. So, and I took advantage of that a fair bit, and the Army would pay for a postdoc. And I had a couple of very good postdocs in my research career. So I still had research going on at UNC. Especially I mentioned David Witten. I learned a hell of a lot of chemistry from David. And photochemistry was just, organic photochemistry was just beginning to, what shall we say, it made a big splash in the 60s, 1960s. And the man who made the big splash was a fellow named George Hammond. And Hammond was mainly at Caltech in that period. He was at Iowa State for a while. And and David Witten came from George Hammond's laboratory from Caltech. So I learned a lot of the modern photochemistry from David, just like we were talking about the modern inorganic chemistry at Cornell back in 1940. And I had these postdocs working in the lab. They worked full time. I could come out to the lab about once a week to oversee them, and I think I had 20 publications from UNC, and one, and that includes three publications I had when I was on the Army Research Office. Also had a sabbatical system, and I took a year sabbatical, went to Germany, and
the Max Planck Institute.
Yes, and that was great fun, and there I got about three publications. So.
So you still stayed pretty active in publications, despite the fact that you were playing a largely administrative role.
Yes, and I thought that was a... Well, you see, the theory the Army has, and it's a good one, an administrator who does nothing but administrative work gets stale on his science. And a researcher cannot do administrative work on the side. So they say, do your administrative work, and so that you don't get stale, keep your finger in research and have a helper, a postdoc, who will pay for, as long as you and he interact, you and she interact. I had a Belgian girl who was very, very good, and married couple. David Witten had the husband and I had the wife. Somebody took care of the baby. Baby was born here. No, baby was born in Europe, then came here, yeah. And we're still in touch. I mean, I had a Christmas card from her. And she was here in the year I spent in sabbatical was, my daughter was 15, so she's about 40 years ago, she was the postdoc. She's retired now. She became a professor at the university in Brussels and sends a Christmas card telling me what's new with them.
So did your family travel with you when you went back and forth to Europe? Was your family with you when you went back and forth for sabbatical?
My family was, yes, yes.
What was it like being back in Europe after all the years in the United States?
Well, it was hard on the family. I had no problem because I went to Germany, my German is fluent. The Max Planck Institute, everybody spoke English. I gave a couple of seminars there, and seminar would be at 4 o'clock, and the institute director at 3:30, I'd ask him, I said, Albert, do you want me to give the seminar in German or in English? And he'd go one way or the other, or he'd say, well, it's up to you. But my daughter was 15, and she didn't know any German. I mean, she knew German when she was 2, because she was born in Germany, and we had a German babe. But at 15, she'd forgotten it all and dumped her into a German school. But she had a great fun, and at the end of the year, we had a couple of the German girls she was friendly with come over here for a month. And my wife was hardest on her because she didn't speak German, and she was too old to learn. My daughter picked up German very well, very fast. But this is true of all American scientists who go on sabbaticals to other places than England or Australia, places like that.
What about for you leaving Europe under the conditions that you did at 17 and then returning that first time to Frankfurt? Was that strange to be returning to Germany all grown up for work, or had enough time passed and the conditions were so different that you didn't think?
Well, I was very interested in what caused the war and Nazism and how it all came about and things, and it was interesting to see things, talk to people, and some things didn't make sense and still don't. For example, this was much, much later. I made a lot of friends there, and one of my friends is a German professor about my age, and I saw him develop from assistant professor, full professor, whatnot. And his last time he was in Germany was in 98, so it's been, 20 years now, no, 15. And we stopped, and he invited us to his house, and I asked him about his wartime years. Well, I had no idea. The man was half Jewish. And how did he survive? His mother was Jewish, his father was not. And when Hitler was taking power, his mother decided she'd escape early and move to France. Left her husband. But of course Hitler took France, they found her, and she was executed. But he, the half-Jewish son, nobody bothered him. And this was a big surprise. They wouldn't put him in the army because he was half-Jewish. And they had him in a labor battalion for a while, but then they decided he wasn't very good in labor. So they let him go to university. And he had a perfectly normal university career. Wow. Which is surprised me. I thought that all the ones who were half Jewish were also treated like the Jews. But no, his mother was, but he wasn't. He lives very comfortably now, retired in Göttingen, the university town. And, a lot of these things you pick up as you go along, as you get friendly with them. My home during my sabbatical was the Max Planck Institute, but I also, because I knew this guy who was a university professor. University and Max Planck, they're completely different. There's a lot of animosity and jealousy between them. But I could get along with both of them. I knew both of these professors a long, long time. And I really enjoyed it. I had a field.
When you became the director of chemistry in 1960 at the Durham U.S. Army Research Office, what were you supposed to, well, how big was the group that you were directing?
All right. We had four people, including myself, four PhD scientists, PhD chemists. At the beginning, we only had two, and I had a chance to fill the other two slots very quickly. And what made a lot of sense to me was most of the program. I inherited the program that was existing. Most of the program was organic chemistry. Mm-hmm. So I went out and looked for an organic chemist. And I was very fortunate in getting a very good one. Was interested in doing administrative work. And I had a chemical engineer on hand, but that was, he didn't stay very long. They found another slot for him. He really didn't fit in. Mm-hmm. And then I could hire an inorganic chemist and a physical chemist. I mean, you're going to have four people. And I was sort of a jack of all trades. Organic, physical, and inorganic made sense, which is what I had. And for much of the time that I was director, these guys continued. And when I went on sabbatical or went over to the European office, the organic chemist, who was by then the senior person there, he would pinch hit for me. He would be acting director. Now again, because it's a small office, organic chemistry to me, as an organic chemist, and we've talked about this, is in two pieces. There is synthetic chemistry, and there's mechanistic chemistry. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate that this guy who worked for me worked for the Army for 30 years, had experience both in synthetic and in mechanistic chemistry. He had a PhD from Caltech, and then he worked with Jack Hine at Georgia Tech, who was a mechanistic guy. And then I hired him. No, he went to Turkey for a couple of years to teach chemistry for it. Yeah. English-speaking Turkish college, and then I picked him off the boat when he came back from Turkey at an ACS meeting in New York. The boat landed and he registered in the employment clearinghouse and landed here, stayed 30 years. We're still good friends. He's retired now in Hilton Head, but I was very fortunate with him. The inorganic chemist, we had a little problem. He was very good for a long time, but then then he decided to embark on his own projects, and he didn't do so well on those. And then later on, the physical chemist, again, he stayed with me 20 years maybe, then branched off. So we had four people. I was an organic chemist, so in a way I was Bob. The Caltech guy was redundant, but the program was about 60% of organic projects that I inherited. So having two of us at the beginning was not too many, because it was mainly organic chemistry. My predecessor was also an organic chemist. He was moved up to be chief scientist, and that's why I got the job as division director. When I was on sabbatical in Germany, I the chief scientist retired, and I fully expected they'd offer me the job. And they did. And I knew the answer. I didn't want it. I enjoyed interacting with chemists. As chief scientist, you'd be interacting with mathematicians, with physicists and whatnot. And how could I? It was not for me.
But you'd had years of experience doing that while you were in Frankfurt. So why?
Well, but that was different. That was more of political thing. I mean, that was more a matter of, all right, I mean, opening up and talking to a geographer in Switzerland, mainly because we want to be able to advertise. We got a contract in Switzerland. Not because I was interested in the geography that he had.
So even though you weren't doing research, you very much enjoyed still being a part of the more specifically chemistry community.
Yes.
So what kind of, when you say you inherited 60% kind of organic chemistry projects, what were the projects that you were overseeing and what did that involve?
He now wants me to tell him what projects I had in 1960.
Just generally.
What did you do in 1960?
I can't tell you.
Well, that's even. I can't either. No, it was. We had some very good.
What was the nature of the work besides just administrative?
University investment. Well, let's take a bigger look. 1960. The National Science Foundation, I think, was established in 1950, something like that. ONR was the first research supporting agency in the US in 1948. The Army's always a Johnny come lately in these things, so they saw everybody else and they got into it. And in 1960, our program was about $1 million, which was a fair bit of money in 1960. The NSF budget was a little more than $1 million, not much. 10 years later, the NSF budget was $10 million, and ours was still $1 million. NSF was growing exponentially. All right, but we had everything. The idea was we support research in areas of interest to the Army laboratories. The Army has about 15 laboratories scattered around the US. Most of them have some chemistry in them, not all. And the job of the Army Research Office here was to keep in, to put, sort of be a transmitter of information between the academic world, say in chemistry or physics or whatever, and the Army laboratory world of chemists and physicists and whatnot.
So all of the Army chemistry labs, not just the one here in Durham. So Durham was...
We didn't have a lab here. We just had an office.
So you were just facilitating
We were just facilitating. We would look for research projects that have some interest to one or more Army laboratories around the country. And Army labs were things like the Missile Command in, where is it, where they shoot missiles out in Alabama.
All right.
The Edgewood, the Chemical Command, where they have chemical warfare stuff. At Watertown, there's the Army Materials Laboratory. They're interested in materials. They're very different interests. I mean, the Missile Command wants unstable things. The Material Command wants stable things. And so getting very stable materials or certain that will stand up to high temperatures, a great interest in one lab, no interest to the other lab, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So we were out on the lookout for things and encouraging the people in the universities to submit proposals to us that may be of interest to this lab or this lab or this lab. And in doing so, we had to get acquainted mm-hmm. with what the labs were interested in, and also get acquainted with the, well, we have 200 PhD granting institutions in the country, and typically maybe 15 chemists in each one, and that's a lot of chemists, and what they were doing, and try to match them. Mm-hmm. And it was great fun to do it. And the same sort of thing is what the Navy does, the Air Force. The Navy and the Air Force each have a research supporting agency like the Army, and they each have a little more money than we do. Mm-hmm. But in the last 50 years, NSF has leapfrogged them all money-wise, mm-hmm. deliberately so. I mean, this was done by Congress deliberately, that NSF should be the primary research supporting agency. Mm-hmm. And they are.
How did that impact the kind of work that you were trying to do?
Well, it made us look harder for the Army relevance. Mm. If NSF will take anything, I mean, they have their own criteria, but Army relevance is not one of them, then we want to be sure that none of the ideas of people in universities are going to fall to the wayside that may have an interest to an Army laboratory somewhere, because NSF couldn't care less about the Army labs. And that's as it should be. NSF looks at scientific merit. And the Navy is interested in what the Navy lab. The Navy has big problems of corrosion on ships, the paint on ships and things. Mm. And, well, the Army has no interest in that. And NSF wouldn't give it any priority, I'm sure. The DOE now has extramural programs. And again, this is things that are of interest to Department of Energy. Mm-hmm. We used to be Atomic Energy Commission. And twice a year, I know you guys know this, all these agencies get together, sit around the table, and exchange information. Where NSF say, we got a program of $70 million in chemistry, and the guy representing the Army Research Office probably says, we got $7 million, and the Navy says, we got $7.5 million, and that sort of thing. And what are you interested in? This is what we're interested in. This is what we're not interested in.
During this time period, again, it's, I mean, you mentioned earlier the Vietnam War. This is also, when you're in this office, there's the space race going on. Did you see any of these offices around the country in any way come together on certain projects related to these larger areas of science being pursued in the U.S.?
Certainly not my office, no.
Not your office? Okay.
No. Let's see if anybody else got into this. No, not really.
Okay. I also noticed that in 1962, you organized a symposium on reversible photochemical processes, and this ultimately led to the biannual series, the International Conferences on Photochemistry. And I was kind of curious to know how that came about.
Well, that's kind of funny. I started here in 1960. And after I got my feet on the ground, and I was also quite hot about new things in photochemistry. especially reversible thing that I found and other people have found about that time. It seemed like this was a good time to have a symposium. And then I discovered that one of the, there was almost unlimited amount of travel money. At that time, there was something called Category Z, I think, Category something, which meant that if we had good reason, we, meaning Army Research Office, had good reason to provide travel from for Professor Price in London to University of Chicago, spend a couple of days with a colleague in Chicago, and then go home, we could do this. And the way we did it is a military aircraft at the time.
Mm-hmm.
A Category Z was a ticket which cost very little money, and actually if it was done for a purpose like this, it cost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And Professor Price would otherwise have to save money for it 20 years before he could afford a ticket to fly to Chicago, where he has a friend or a colleague or somebody who's doing work with the two of them would benefit greatly to exchange information. And we could do it in either direction. So after I discovered that, I said, what the hell? I said, we could have a real good meeting here. It also put the office on the map.
Mm-hmm.
And put Duke University on the map. And let's do it. And I knew all the players in the game. I decided in 1960 to have the conference. In 61, I took a trip to Europe and visited some of the people like you, told them about the meeting, I'd like them to come. And some very prominent, well, some photochemists at the time of the beginning of their careers, who 20 years later became very prominent, all came. It was their first trip to the US, which is a big thing. There's one of them who really, something that I never expected. All right, I'll tell you that one of them that is not necessarily going to come up in your write-up. All right, here's this young fellow in Germany, and somebody tells me he's doing good work and right on the topic of the conference. He's never been to US, he was maybe 30 years old. Okay. Good enough for me. I write him a letter. I think I visited him in 61 and made a good impression. How would you like to come to the meeting? He'd love to come to the meeting. Never been to the US. Okay. And he gives a paper, and the meeting had about 150 participants. And now, curtain. And the next meeting, to come back to your question, how did this meeting get to be the first one of the series? But nothing happened in 62, 64, 65. In 1967, an Indian fellow, Indian from India, a very, very well-known photochemist at the time, his last name was Srinivasa. You may want to write that down. Okay. The German fellow I was just talking about, his name was Schulte Frohlinde, that's more complicated. Anyhow, Srinivasan decides in 1956 that he'd like to have a meeting like I had. IBM would give him the money. He was at IBM Yorktown Heights, you know, 50 miles from New York City, something like this. And Srinivasan was a go-getter. He got money from IBM and they had a damn good meeting.
Mm-hmm.
I was there. And even though there was a five-year interval, he decided that the people who organized the previous meeting And this meeting should all get together in sort of an international committee, and that this should be the beginning of a series which traces its origin to my meeting.
Mm.
I said, fine. So in 67 we had a meeting in Yorktown Heights, and Srinivasan has disappeared from the scene. He may be retired, he may be dead, I don't know. But he was very active in photochemistry in the 60s and 70s and 80s still. Okay. All right, but now to come back to the German fellow. All right, the German fellow comes in 62, never been in the US, and nobody ever heard of him very much. But later on, he starts making waves, and within about 15 years after the trip to the US, he becomes institute director at one of the Max Planck Institutes of photochemistry, where the previous institute director retired. The Germans have a very strict retirement age. You hit 70, you're out. So Schulter Frohlinde is the name of the guy who had his first trip in 62. In 1970 or 75, whenever, he becomes the successor of a very well-known older man named Schenck at one of the Max Planck Institute, and Germany Max Planck Institute is the top of the world for research. All right. And I get to know Schulter Frohlinde some more. He still looks upon me as, he still appreciated my inviting him when he wasn't known back in 1962. We collaborate on some projects. I go to his institute many times. I think I published three or four papers with either him or some of his associates. So I was a welcome guest to his institute. But then a funny thing happens. He invited me to his house in where he lived in Germany. And one of his sidekicks that I collaborated with, a fellow named Gerner. He was younger than either one of us. And I bump into Gerner at a meeting which was the, I don't know, 18th or whatever, meeting of the series in Vancouver.
Hmm.
And Gerner says, you will be hearing from Professor Schulter Frohlinde when you get home. Here we are in Vancouver. He knows my home is the East Coast. I said, well, we're going to Alaska, but all right. And what happened to Schulter Frohlinde? He fulfilled his requirements. He retired from that institute when he had to retire. And apparently at that point he left his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And got involved with a American artist whom he met in Italy somewhere, and he left the wife and moved into the Washington DC area.
Mm-hmm.
And what he was writing to me about is, I got his letter, I don't think I still have it. He tells me the story, he now lives with so-and-so woman, and she was an artist in the Chevy Chase area, and everybody among his neighbors, they're all members of the Cosmos Club. So he'd like to become a member of the Cosmos Club. And he went through the directory and found that I was a member of the Cosmos Club, and I'd known him all these years. Would I recommend him for membership? I said, sure. So I filled out the forms and he got elected. And then about 6 months later, the ACS met in Washington. I thought I'd surely meet the guy. No, he wasn't registered, nothing. So I pick up the phone and call him. I had his number at the time. And the lady answers. Well, she thought, yes, he wasn't home now, but she thought he'd probably be at the meeting sometime. He never showed up at the meeting. He gave up chemistry and everything, his wife, chemistry and everything, and moved in with this woman in Chevy Chase. And I don't think if my giving him a trip in 1962 had anything to do with that. But
I don't think you can take responsibility for that.
The
So did you ever see him again?
I haven't seen him since, no. He's a nice guy, good looking, good scientist. These Max Planck Institute offers are somebody suddenly gets one from the sky. I mean, it just falls on his lap. I was at a meeting in Germany once, not too long ago, 30 years ago, and he was a professor in Switzerland, and he says, I asked him if I could get a ride with him to the nearest railway station. Yes, he says, you can help me decide. He says, they invited me to become an institute director at the same institute where the other guy retired from. I think he is actually the successor of the guy who moved to Chevy Chase. And I don't know if I should leave Switzerland, and that's an ugly part of Germany where that institute is. It's in the Ruhr district. And well, I rode with him for 2 hours, and he hadn't decided, but later on he took the job. Max Planck. And they give you research support, everything. I mean, you don't have to do anything the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you stay in Durham until 77. You have your 1 year sabbatical at the Max Planck Institute.
That was in
72-73. I know during this time period you also reapproached the cis indigo problem, initially with A.F. Zenhausen while at Duke?
Yeah, he was one of my postdocs. Yeah.
Okay, and then David Witten at UNC.
No, David Witten was my mentor. He was a faculty member at UNC.
Oh, okay. But in 77, you decide again...
Go back to Europe.
To go back to Europe, and... in that position, you were going to be the chief of chemistry branch of the U.S. Army European Research
Chief
Office.
Of a one-man branch.
So, one, why is it that you wanted to head back? And two, what were you doing as chief of a one-man branch?
All right. I went... 1977, my daughter was... ready to go to college.
She was 20.
She was born in 57, mm-hmm. So she was already in college, I guess. Okay. And the office had moved from Frankfurt to London,
mm-hmm.
which made life much easier, would make life much easier for my wife, because the street signs and the store signs and the sales signs are all in English,
mm-hmm.
and not in German. So this seemed like a... And number three, the head of the office was a good friend, and he just assigned, he was the commanding officer here, and his next assignment was London, and I knew I could work with him very well.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was in favor of it. The only thing, I think I got $1,000 less or something. Salary. But again, the job was a wonderful job. You travel all over Western Europe and go to meetings. I enjoyed meetings and see a lot of my old friends, like people I've known for 15, 20 years before that.
So was this position similar to the one that you had when you first went to?
Everything changed.
Okay. How did it?
Europe changed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Europe when did I first go?
77.
First time you went was 57. 56, 57 was when you first got there.
I think you saw when you were a child when you first went to Europe?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, the first, when you were based in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
You went in December 1956.
56, yeah. Okay, 57. So Europe in 57 and Europe in 1977 is day and night.
Mm-hmm.
In 57 they're trying to recover from the war, rebuild, whatnot, and 1977 all that's behind them. Now Europe is, you also have the European community, and Europe is getting to be a big economic power and whatnot, everything is all well settled. The dollar is worth less in terms of research support. You don't have any money to. It was mainly establishing contacts, travel, bringing people together, going to meetings, finding interesting things of interest to the army. So it was a completely, it was not just a different location, it was a different job, really.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same office. Nominally, it was the same job, but it was not.
Hmm.
Because you had, one of my fellow members in the office was spent all his time on computers, and no computers 20 years before.
Hmm.
And we, had more freedom to travel, we could go to the meetings and Eastern Europe, not just Western Europe. There was it was much more on liaison, more emphasis on liaison, and far less on buying research.
Mm-hmm.
And then the surroundings were different, of course. You operate out of London versus out of Frankfurt.
Did you see a transition in the funding that you get during you got during this? Did you see a transition in the amount of funding that you got during this period? Because this is, of course, the Carter presidency to the Reagan presidency, and
the Army European office had almost zero funding for research support. We had enough to pay for the staff, we had a good travel budget, because that was it. I mean, we'd go to meetings and make friends. And some of these, and then we had travel budget for, once you make friends, is to get them together with their American counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but there was almost zero travel, zero budget for research support, none.
Okay.
But there is also, I think, what Dave's pointing at too, there's a change in foreign policy rhetoric from when you get there in 77 to the Reagan administration and its relationship to the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. And you're there at that bridging moment of the late 70s and early 80s. And so you're traveling all over Europe. I mean, is this something that you sense in the meetings that you go to or in your interactions with other scientists?
I'm trying to remember, there was a meeting, actually a couple of meetings, Soviet Union we could go to. There were, let's say there was a slight relaxation of where to draw the line between Eastern and Western Europe, yes. That was in East Germany. There was a meeting in East Germany, yes. And my main claim to fame at that one, I arranged a wedding, a marriage. An American chemist with a Hungarian lady chemist.
Oh my goodness, you're having a meeting?
Yes.
Well, I came to return a book. I will be quick.
No problem.
Goodbye. Hey there, my dear.
Hello.
Good to see you.
She probably doesn't remember who I am.
You got a familiar face, I'm sure.
We were good friends 3-4 years ago. And she's losing her memory.
That's a shame.
So you were in that position as the Only individual. You were the chief of a one-man chemistry.
Well, branch. That was, again, we had, they established this, what do you call it, organizational structure back in 1960-61, something like this.
Hmm.
They would have three or four scientists. There'd be a colonel who's a chief, and there'd be probably one military guy who was frequently from the Signal Corps, because they had their special needs for signal communication, things like this. And then four civilian scientists covering chemistry, physics, frequently biology, and maybe computer. By then computers got into mathematics and computers.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So there'd be four civilian scientists at the time. And then there was a fifth one who was sent from the army, has a waterways experimental station. It's down in Mississippi, on the Mississippi River. And a good friend came from there. And he was added to the civilian staff, and he handled the, what we call it, geography and whatever is beyond geography, how the land would stand up to water and things like that. So that would be five civilians at the time, yes.
Okay. And you stayed there for 6 years. And then came back to the same office here in Durham.
Yeah, I got my old job.
But they expanded it to, instead of just chemistry, it was now chemical and biological sciences?
Well, that was changed in 73.
Okay. What was the reason for that change?
All right. The Army Research Office here was established gradually in 1965 maybe. And then there was also an Army Research Office in Washington. And in Washington, pretty soon there was nothing left for them to deal with except the life sciences. And there was a small group of two or three people who had the responsibility for that in Washington. In 1972, somebody finally discovered that this is silly. You have all the sciences in Durham except one, and one is in Washington, has got no foothold, nothing. So they decided to move life sciences to Durham. Except the people didn't want to move except one guy. So Bill Mortland came, and everybody else disbanded, sort of. They went to work for other people.
Hmm.
All right, so then Bill Mortland was down here, and he was life sciences, and the other divisions all had four or five people in them. And the question was, the high command had to cope with this question of what do you do with Bill Morton? Set up a life sciences division like they had in Washington. And that meant hiring three more people, probably. Or absorb Bill Morton somewhere in the existing structure, which is a damn sight easier. You got one guy, you could. And so they looked around. And they saw me, and they say, well, life sciences is closest to chemistry. It's closer than to physics or math or earth sciences or something like this. Will you take Bill Mortimer? I say, I don't know beans about life sciences, but for administrative end, I could help him. Yes, I could sign his time card and that sort of thing. I'll take it. Well, after that, Bill was mad at me. He wanted to have his own division. And then later on, we became good friends. The division program got larger by 20%, which was his program, the life sciences program. And nothing had really changed.
Okay.
I signed his time card. And then later on, the surprise Bill was, when I went up to him about 6 months later, I said, Bill, I think we ought to go to bat for adding a second person in life sciences. What? I thought you were against life science. I said, I'm not against life science, I just don't know anything about it. So we made a big pitch for a second person. And we had this CEO who went up to London later on. He had a PhD in math from Caltech, even though he was a military guy. And PhD from Caltech in the sciences, nothing to sneer at. The guy was real sharp. So we made a presentation that we need more. And the CEO stood up and he says, well, he says, you guys made a good case. Convinced me that you really need more than one person, but you didn't convince me that you needed two. So how about one and a half? Like Solomon. And we hired a half-time, a PhD in bacteriology, a woman who married a woman whose husband was head of biochemistry at NC State. So she didn't need the money in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Although she negotiated for the money. Boy, she and I are still good friends. She still lives in Raleigh, and Bill is dead, and so at ARO they still have, I think, combined chemistry and biological sciences, and because biology is not all that big, nothing is big, but say if you have a $8 million chemistry program and a $2 or $3 million biology program, then it doesn't make sense to have a separate division.
Mm. So after 2 years back here as director, you decide to retire from...
Oh, I decided that long before that. I just came back to reestablish the position as a super great position.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed there for about a year. I straighten out a few things that had gone bad, and then I knew I was going to work a year and a half, roughly, something like that, yeah.
Okay. And when you finished off your work with the Army Research Office, you began consulting, and you did that for about a decade.
Yes, that was fun.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you were doing?
This was funny. It wasn't my idea. I went to an Army-sponsored meeting at Edgewood, which was the Chemical Warfare Center. Every year they had a big meeting with other university people. And this was, say, early December. By then I had announced I was going to retire January 3rd. And one of the professors from Florida, an English-born professor, can't remember his name, came up to me. He says, oh, he says, you're going to retire? Yeah. I said, boy, we'll have to have you come down to the University of Florida because you can probably give our faculty lots of good advice about how to get research support. I hadn't thought of that. I said, I'd be glad to. I mean, I had a cousin living in Florida, a lot of other reasons to go to Florida. Why not? So he had a very, very naive idea of what I could do for him. But anyhow, we had a meeting for 2 days. He says, come for 2 days. The first day you tell us what the different agencies are interested in, and we'll have the faculty busy with notebooks and things, writing down all the brilliant ideas. And the second day they'll come in with proposals that you can critique, and they'll send them off. It's not that simple.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anyhow, they had me, and they thought it was worthwhile to talk to the faculty about my vision or how I see the best chances of getting research support. And then I thought about this some more, and I decided I always enjoyed interacting with university faculty in chemistry. And I said, now if I did something like this, I could offer my services to the department, and they could pull in those faculty members who they think need the most advice or can most benefit from advice. I mean, they wouldn't pull in the Nobel laureates because they already know what to do. And I didn't need the money. The government retirement system is very good. But I could collect frequent flyer miles. So I advertised this to various chemistry departments. And what I really enjoyed most is interacting with chemistry faculty.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that I could maintain. So I started this and wrote letters to people I knew, mainly either senior people in chemistry departments or chairman. And the next thing I knew, every year for something like 10 years, I had about 10 customers where they'd pay my way. I'd spend a day or two at the university. How the university arranged my visits was up to them. Typically, it would be, except what I first offered, it was I'd give a talk first, I don't know, 1 hour talk or something like this, and over. And then they would bring in individual faculty members who they thought would benefit by having a...
Attention staff, the fire alarm is being tested. Is it...
Okay. They would meet with me one-on-one and for as long as they choose. And this worked out very well. And by the time I got through, I quit the whole thing in 96 because we had a big family crisis. My daughter had a child, she was pregnant. She had a child, a second child, who had all kinds of birth defects. At the same time, her husband came down with a brain tumor, a non-operable brain tumor, so it was a big, big crisis. But for 10 years I did this, and I went to such schools as Caltech, Pennsylvania twice. Palladino was the guy's name who organized my visit, George Palladino. At, he was assistant to the chairman at Pennsylvania. And he had me come for a second visit, that surprised me, just to talk to one person.
Hmm.
I had the usual thing for one visit, talk maybe to six people and a group, maybe 10. And then 6 months or 8 months later, he says, can you come sometime in the fall? There's somebody I want you to meet. I said, all right, I mean, if he pays my way, I'll come and talk to the devil. And I don't know who the person was that I talked to, but I was surprised he had just one person.
Hmm.
And the universities were about half the Ivy League schools, half the Big Ten schools. I had preference for the University of Utah because I could combine that with skiing. I went 2 or 3 times. And what?
So did your wife accompany you sometimes if you were making... Did your wife accompany you sometimes if these were kind of combined business pleasure?
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah.
Sometimes, yes. I mean, I was at Caltech when they put me up in the faculty club there to spend the night. At the same time, when they were making a movie with, what's his name, one of the big movie stars. It was interesting. I mean, a lot of these things are very interesting. And then places like Arkansas, I didn't even know how to fly to the University of Arkansas. I talked to the University of North Carolina here in paying my way to Washington every year for me to talk to the agencies and get updated on what's new. And for that, they could consult me anytime. And they did. And it worked out very nicely for 10 years. And I really enjoyed the meetings with the faculty. It was great fun. Yeah, I was MIT and Caltech and half the Ivy League. So, on the other hand, there were schools like the University of North Carolina Greensboro, which is not a research institution, and East Carolina College, which is also not a research institution. But the price was low. I think I got something like $300 a day. Usually it was one day for smaller school and travel expenses. And like Greensboro or East Carolina, it's 6 cents or 8 cents a mile or something, and you're there and back. Didn't even have to spend the hotel. But the Pennsylvania visits, the two of them I remember because the second one was so unique, that just one person, and Palladino is the guy who had me. My other connection to Philadelphia was this. As usual, I took the job at the Bureau of Standards to work for the Army's Natick Laboratories. Natick was still being built, and as usual in government projects, the building was behind schedule. And the Army had the Quartermaster Corps had a pretty sad looking research laboratory at the Philadelphia Army Depot, which is somewhere between the center of Philadelphia and the airport. And it's so when they told me, they said, well, we're running behind schedule. You want to start in Philadelphia or you want to just come later? I said, what the hell, I'll start in Philadelphia. So I actually lived in Philadelphia about 6 months and worked at the Philadelphia Army Depot. And it also meant that for several months, there's no work to be done. The Natick lab was not finished. The Philadelphia, the chemistry was out of it. And I wrote a big review article using the University of Pennsylvania Library. This was a review article this was all in 54. Must have been 54. I think it was published in 55 on the cis-trans isomerization of conjugated compounds. And I was kind of surprised because chem reviews at the time was known to be pretty fussy about what they published, but it was published in 55. And at that time we didn't know much about it. It was a sporadic knowledge about cis-trans isomerization of conjugated compounds. And yes, it was quite different from non-conjugated compounds. And I needed a library, and of course, University of Pennsylvania, fine library.
Sure.
I could have had a library anywhere else just as well, but so happened I was in Philadelphia with no lab. And
a lot of time on your hands.
And Navy and no lab.
Yeah.
Still getting paid. I had to do, felt I had to do something. And a lot of work getting a review article together.
Ooh.
That's money. So.
So we've covered a lot of ground in 2 days. Do you think we've missed anything?
Well, let me go to the little boys' room.
Sure.
Check, okay.
Yeah, more.